Someone wrote like this. In follow-up to the discussion of chocolate spread sandwiches from last time, how do we stay motivated, positive, and non-judgmental in a socio-cultural environment that does not match our goals? I understand that you have to give in sometimes to the reality, but how about in real issues like young children walking around themselves, lack of car safety, health, hygiene issues, or other dangers? How do we teach or explain to young children tolerance in a positive way, that some people do X and we do Y? So first of all, I liked what the person wrote. I think that's a very good thing to tell children. Exactly that. Some people do X and we do Y. That's a very good answer. Even though children have a hard time, we said they see black and white, but this is an area where they have to learn to appreciate gray. I don't think we should say a sentence like, I disagree with their parenting. They're being mafkir their kids. I know someone who always told his kids, Israelis only care about a clean house, so they let their kids grow up in the streets. Americans don't care about a clean house, so they bring up their kids at home. Why would you tell kids that? I mean, he got what he accomplished, what he said. So his children all view themselves as not Israelis. His children all view it as, this is okay, this is what Israelis do, but we don't do that. I think we want our children to view themselves as Israelis in a positive way. Now, the same is true with hygiene. I remember the shock we got when one of our kids came home and said, after they used the facilities, I don't know if it was no one washes their hands or they don't even have soap in the gun. Soap doesn't even exist in the gun. So you ask yourself, do I leave my kid in that gun? What's interesting is that our pediatrician, who was a very good pediatrician, said to me, why are you so convinced soap does anything? Water's great. The most important thing about washing your hands is water. Soap is not the big deal. So I still have a hard time psychologically connecting to that, but that's what? Yeah. But that's what the medical professional said. So we can explain to a child why it's important to wash their hands with soap, but we have to be careful not to really, not to come down and put down the other side. And the same is true with lice. I don't know where you guys grew up, but we had head checks every month when I was growing up. And if a kid had lice, they sent him home. He had to get checked. And if he was clean, he could come to class. And if he wasn't clean, he couldn't come to class. That doesn't yet exist here, right? Mm. But my kids don't have to hear that where I grew up, this was different. I think the questioner really put it right. Some people do it X, we do Y, and I think that's a big key to how to bring kids up. It is legitimate. A person can say to a child, "We love you. We're concerned about you." There are different types of approaches. You know, these parents let their kids ride down the main street on their bike and hope that no car comes out and hits them. And we don't let you do that. What? I mean, there are certain norms that we see here in the yeshuv that make you wonder, Yudavin, that those kids will make it to 120. But I don't think we should be putting other people down. When a child is older, when a child hits the age of 7, 8, 9, you could tell a child, you know, when you'll be a parent, then you'll decide if that's something you want your kids to do. Maybe you will do things differently. I had the good fortune of being close during the years I was in Merkez Harav with a family called the Ha'etan family. Now, Ha'etan, their father was the Rav of I forgot the name of the yeshuv. Yeah, and he eventually became also the Rav of the whole Shomron. He was the Rav of the Shomron. So, Kedumim. He was the Rav in Kedumim. And, if I'm not mistaken. And his wife told me that there were many times that there were pe'iliyot, there were things that the Bnei Akiva or Ezra, whatever it was doing there, that the kids would come home and say, we didn't participate. And the parents would say, why didn't you participate? And they said, we thought that you wouldn't agree that we should be a part of this. So that means the parents taught the children you're part of this society, and there are certain things we don't agree with, and you don't do, and the children connected to it on a level, they reached a point where they would sometimes come home of their own volition and say, we didn't think you'd want us to do that. So children can appreciate that there's a sensitivity, there's a way of a home. And we have to give our children the tools to deal with that. I once davened in a shul where there was a man who drove to shul on Shabbos. And then he'd reach into his jacket pocket and take out candies without a wrapper and give them out to the kids. Now, you want your kids to be comfortable with the people in shul. On the other hand, this man is Michal Shabbos. And if I don't know what the wrapper is, how can I trust the kashrus of the candies, right? I'd like to think he eats kosher, but I really have no way of knowing. So the kids would run over to me in shul and say, Abba, is this kosher, right? So you don't want to do that in front of the person in shul. So what did I always answer? Of course it's kosher. And then I take it from them, right? Abba, we're not eating it now. Right now, we'll wait till we come home. And then you leave shul and you tell the kids, look, if a Jew gives you something, you should think it's kosher. They didn't see the guy drive to shul. That's not a question, is it kosher? The question is, do we eat this hechsher? I don't have to explain to them everything that's behind it. They have to learn that. And I taught the kids, you know, you don't ask me that question in shul. You don't ask me that in front of the person. The question is two things. A, is it kosher? That's not a question to ask me. If a Jew gives you something, you can assume it's kosher. From their perspective, he is a kosher Jew. They have no concept. And the second thing, they can learn a sensitivity. And shul, you don't ask that question. When we leave shul, when we're out of earshot, when we're on the way home, you could ask me if this is a hechsher we eat. It's not a question of whether it's kosher, it's do we eat that hechsher. So I think that's the direction we want to go. We want to bring our children to a place where they can see that, X and Y. Now, you'll ask me, can a 3-year-old see that? I doubt it. Can a 4-year-old see that? Border between 4 and 5, they start understanding a little bit. But I do think that there's an attitude that prevails in the house, and the kids get it eventually. But that's a little bit later in the chinuch of a kid. My toddler loves to daven, but will only accept using a real bencher or sitter. We're concerned that this isn't respectful or proper treatment of an item with Hashem's name in it, as she sometimes ends up crumbling the pages or leaving it on the floor. Is this okay? Do you have any suggestions? So this is a question that borders between halacha and chinuch. So let's start with the halacha side of it, and then we'll go on to the chinuch side of it. The halacha side of it is that we're not allowed to cause Hashem's name to be destroyed. If there's really Hashem's name written in the bencher, then I'm not allowed to do that. There was an interesting shaila that someone from the Sfardi in the yeshuv sent me by WhatsApp. They made a business card. They're a caterer. They made a business card. And on the back of the business card was either Ala Michi or Tfilat HaDerech. And the printer, by mistake, in one place left Hashem's name. So the question was, are they allowed to leave their business cards on the tables? Because let's say 2 people take the business card, and then 3 or 4 business cards remain there. What happens? Things spill on it, it gets thrown out, and the answer is no. They have to put the whole pack of business cards they just bought in Gniza. They could talk to the printer, they could see if they can get part of their money back, but we're not allowed to take something that has Hashem's name on it and leave it in a place where it'll get destroyed. When I was in yeshiva once, there was a delivery of sfarim. Hundreds of sfarim. And it was about to rain. So the delivery guy said, I'm leaving it here. And the one who made the order said, we agreed that you're bringing it into the building. And the delivery guy said, I'm leaving. And it starts drizzling. So the guy from the store started working for the next 25 minutes, sweating and carrying the things and bringing people to help him. And I stood there and I asked him, halachically, why are you doing that? If your contract agrees, he brings it into the store, why do you have to schlep now? You're going to work now. So he said to me, you're talking halacha, but there's an issa, right? There's an issa. You're not allowed to erase Hashem's name. I can't leave it here. Technically, if it gets destroyed in the rain, he can't sue me. You're right. It's against the contract. But hilchatit, I can't let Hashem's name get destroyed. He's right. He's right. So we cannot give a child a venture if I know the child, if it has Hashem's name in it, and the child's going to suck on it, destroy it, get it ruined. I can't do that. Hilchatit, I can't do that. So our question really begins with the question of, is there a way to ensure they don't destroy it? Or can I find a bencher that doesn't have Hashem's name on it? Or can I find something that they'll think is a bencher, which really isn't a bencher, which is what I do with our little kids. You know, I'll give them, you get all these little pamphlets in the mail. So I'll give them something like that. They don't know the difference. But again, here the chinuch really stems from the halacha, because the halacha doesn't allow me to take Hashem's name and put it in a place where I think it'll get destroyed. So if there is Hashem's name in that bencher, you have to give them something else. If most of the time they treat it nicely, and sometimes they might throw it on the floor, for that you'll pick it up and put it away. Our issue is more if they suck on it, if they destroy it. Not so much if they're going to drop it every so often. That's not an issue. And you can find also things that are made for kids, which are made of stronger paper, where they won't destroy it. There are children's sidurim and things like that. Okay. There was another question here. How can I instill in my child inner self-confidence and self-worth? So this was part of other questions which we dealt with. I want to discuss one tool that helps children really build their self-worth. But before that, we'll discuss a different tool. Okay, Rabbi Beryl Wine told the story of his daughter who lives in South Bend, Indiana. And they came to South Bend, Indiana, and it's a very modern day school. And his son-in-law has payas, so his grandchildren all have payas. So he told the following story. 2 weeks into the school year, all the kids started coming home and telling their parents they want to grow payas too. Because the kids came into South Bend with such self-worth that they didn't feel funny. They caused all the other kids in the class to feel funny. Why don't we have those? So that's self-worth. And that's a type of self-worth which I think comes from parents who have self-worth. So when you want your children to have self-worth, you have to, this goes back to the concept of what's good and what's bad. A number of years ago, there was a child that a terrorist grabbed him and started stabbing him. I don't remember which yeshuva this was in. The child wiggled and fought the terrorist as he had the knife in him. He broke the terrorist's knife and continued fighting him as he was stabbed and wounded with a broken knife in his back, and he continued fighting the terrorist. And to my mind, that child isn't just amazing because of what they did, they're also amazing because their parents were able to give them a set of values that they were able to stand up to something. And I think that comes from parents who have built themselves in a strong way. When parents bring themselves to a point where they're strong in their concept of right and wrong, and it's not at the expense of the kids, but on the contrary, kids are partners in that. So then kids end up having that same self-worth. There's another thing which helps kids build self-worth, and that is when you give them real compliments and you have real expectations of them. So Shabbos is coming in and there's a lot that has to get done. One parent will tell the kids, you play in the room and let me get Shabbos done. Another parent will tell the kids, I want you to peel the potatoes. And then when the child peels the potatoes, they say, thank you, that was a big help. Again, the key is to say, thank you, that was a big help. If you're going to say, hey, you didn't peel over here and you didn't peel over there, and you peeled too much and now I have too small a potato, so you didn't accomplish anything. That's an understatement. There has to be real expectations. Give the kid a real task and then real compliments. When a child feels like they did something that's real, then they start having real self-worth. If you came home with groceries and there's something that the five-year-old knows how to put away and you ask them, it's hard for me, can you please take this and put it away? And the child did, and you say thank you, the child starts seeing, hey, I matter. But that's only if it's real. I've seen many children whose parents look for how to compliment them and then they give them fake compliments for things that they don't really mean, and the children sense that, and that destroys their self-worth. It has the counter effect. because the child senses this isn't right, this isn't real. And then they don't know how to gauge themselves. When a child knows that when it's good, they tell me it's good. When it's not good, they're not going to tell me that. They start developing a real self-image. But it has to be real. So there has to be real praise. Now, you'll tell me, but I asked them to clean the room and they only did an 80% job. That's fine. So don't say they did 100%. Don't lie. Just say, you guys did a really nice job. They did a nice job for their age. We shouldn't lie. We have to avoid lying. I always tell my students that I will not lie to them when I praise them. I tell them, look, if I think the person is lousy in A, I won't compliment them in A. I'll find B to compliment him on. If the guy has a lousy personality, I'll tell him he has nice shoes. You know, there are other ways to compliment the person. But it's important that people know that the praise is sincere. And that's what builds people. There are a few more questions. I don't know how important it is for people. I want to first hear if people have questions here before we go on to other questions that were sent in. Are there any questions in the crowd? Yeah, he has questions. No? Okay. So we'll go on to a third question. Do young children need to hear Havdalah at any point, or can they just be sleeping and not need? So this was a question back from the summer. So children, until they start having a concept of Shabbos, our rule in Chinuch is that a child has to be of age that they can do it. So when a child needs to be in bed before it's time for Havdalah, they don't have to hear Havdalah. As the child grows, they're going to reach the age of 8 and 9. Then you start having a question, does the child have to hear Havdalah? Should they wait up in bed, etc.? But until the child really reaches an age where it makes sense for them to be up, so in the winter they'll hear Havdalah, and in the summer they won't. That's what Am Yisrael always did. Children should hear Havdalah when they're of the age that they can be awake for Havdalah, where it's normal for them to be up for Havdalah. Playing with toys on Shabbat and teaching Muktzah, at what age is this appropriate? So, we didn't do this yet, right? I'm not repeating, right? We didn't cover this. Okay. So, the general rule is, if we're talking about Muktzah in the sense of something that's electric, if we're talking about something that the child should understand, it's Muktzah. So, you start at the age where the child can understand. I don't do that on Shabbos, which is usually somewhere around the age of 3. I'm saying, depends on the kid. You're going to have kids that can get it at 2, 2.5. But usually until a child is 3-ish, you're not going to get anywhere. So that's when it comes to an electronic toy, a toy that makes noise. The right thing is put it away. The child shouldn't have that temptation on Shabbos. And that's fine. The issue really comes up with Lego. So until a child is somewhere 8-ish, you don't have to do anything with Lego. Let the child play. What I'm saying now is Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Building with Lego, I can't build with Lego with the child, according to those opinions that prohibit it. I can't build on Shabbos, but the child can play. I don't have to worry about that. As the child grows and can understand, it would be a good idea to teach the child not to build a garage on Shabbos, because there you run into a more severe issue of ohel. If they're going to build a little garage with their Lego, and then, again, an OL by halachic definition is a tefach by a tefach. That's not so big. You can build that with Lego. This is an OL, right? Once you have this this amount, right, so you built an OL. So kids can build that for their cars and their stuff. So when a child gets old enough, 8, 9, to understand, so you're going to teach them that they shouldn't do on Shabbat. Some kids can understand that younger, at age 6. It depends on the child.
Is the Esser of Lego the same for magnet tiles?
There's no problem with magnets. They can build whatever they want. Ohel. I didn't hear that. It would be the same thing in Ohel.
Good to know.
In Ohel, you'd have the same thing. But every other building, I don't think you can build a tefach by tefach with magnets.
Right, for sure.
Yeah? Okay. I don't know. Okay. Should a mother still try to daven when her kids are around if she knows she will be disturbed? Did we deal with this?
No.
So this question breaks down into two topics, halacha and hashkafa. So maybe we'll start with the hashkafa and then we'll go on to the halacha. Mommies are people too. And imas also need a connection with their bon shalom. So when we're going to discuss the halacha, we have to remember that it's not just a halachic question. If a person comes up with a maskana that, I don't have to daven, I'm pater, where will their Yiddish guide be in 2 years and in 5 years and in 10 years? And how will they be a good ima to their kids? So part of what we factor in this question is the spiritual, the emotional, the religious need that imas have to daven. It's not just a question of halacha. Technically, the halacha is that when a woman says birchas haTorah, she was yotzei her chiyuv in tefillah. So that's a calming thing. That you, when the Chafetz Chaim brings the Magen Avraham, the opinion that women should really be davening, he doesn't mean to say that women now have to be under pressure when they're mothers and all day long they're osik b'mitzvah, that they have to all day figure out, when am I going to catch that mincha? When am I going to catch that shachris? The Chafetz Chaim was saying as a perspective. And what the Chafetz Chaim said was not the minhag. And before the Chafetz Chaim, people didn't do it. Even the Magen Avraham, who is the source of this opinion, begins by saying, no one does this. So our mothers and our grandmothers, we all know, they didn't daven. They said a short tefillah, they said a birchas haTorah. You didn't find women. I mean, when I was a kid, women showed up to shul. They showed off their hats and stuff. I'm saying it was a fashion show when I was a kid. But davening, they didn't daven. That just like, I don't know if you understood that line. I mean, when I was a kid, the fashion was that women walked around with huge hats. It wasn't like a regular hat. It was a hat that could be an umbrella. What? I'm showing my age, yeah. I'm saying it was a different deal. I mean, you could look up to the women's section and see all these fancy hats. I mean, it was a different world. The idea of davening, a woman is really yotze once she says one tefillah during the day. You say a shevach, you say a bakasha, you say a shevach. Praise, request, praise. You are yotze your chiv of tefillah. And you have that in birchas haTorah. A person should say birchas haShachar. A person should have blessings in their life. But when we speak about tefillah, it's not from the vantage point of you have a chiv. A woman should not be walking around all day thinking, how am I going to get that mincha in? If you can daven mincha, good for you. But mitzad nahalacha, the minhag always was that women didn't daven. And there are two approaches to this. That most people were of the approach. Today they teach the girls a different thing. You might have learned a different thing in seminary. Today they teach it differently. But what was taught always was that women weren't chayev. Today they teach the girls they are chayev. So even if you're going to go with the opinion that says that women are chayev, they're only chayev if they're spending their time freely. But when a person's a parent, when a person's building a house, when a person has so many mitzvos that they're dealing with all day, those mitzvos take precedent. And that's why the baseline is that women don't have to walk around with this pressure, I have to daven. However, if women separate themselves completely from tefillah, they're going to find themselves in a different place in a year or two or three. And that's why it is important to figure out, am I going to get a tefillah in? Every day, one tefillah in? Am I going to get in a tefillah on Shabbos? How am I going to stay connected? It's not just a question of what my chiyuv is. It's a question of we have to remain connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam and to Yiddishkeit. And that's not going to happen on its own. And you don't feel so holy changing diapers. You'd like to feel holy. You should feel holy. You are doing mitzvos, but it's hard. You don't feel that connection. So it is important from a spiritual perspective, to figure out how you do fit in meaningful moments with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now, those meaningful moments might be to say a parak of Tehillim. Those meaningful, you have to figure out how you could get those meaningful moments with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But a person shouldn't go through a day where they didn't talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That shouldn't happen. It's not just a question of what the chiyuv is. From the chiyuv, yeah, we're covered. Okay. The average mother is osik b'mitzvah all day. She doesn't really have the time under a normal schedule. Maybe there are some women who can. If a woman is spending an hour a day on Facebook, so no, she should daven. If she has the hour a day to be on Facebook or WhatsApp or whatever, then she should daven. But usually people are getting a minute here on Facebook, a minute there on WhatsApp. It's not that they have the setting. In terms of should a mother try to daven when her kids are around, she knows she will be disturbed. That depends. Again, if she can fit it in. So the fact that the kids will nag her here and there, she should still daven if it works for her, if there'll be any meaning in it. But is it better to spend the time with her kids or let them see her daven? That depends on how many hours a day she has with her kids. If she only has an hour a day with her kids, she doesn't belong davening. She has to be with those kids. If she has 4 hours a day with her kids, if she has a larger chunk of time of day with her kids, so then it's fine that every so often they'll see her davening. But that depends to a large degree how much time she's really spending with the kids. There was one more question which we'll just touch on, unless people have questions here. No questions. Okay, so one parent, I'm not finding the question here, but one parent asked, their child had sensory issues and they had an issue wearing a kippah. How did they get their child to connect to kippah? So first of all, this question was asked 450 years ago of the Marshal. There was a man who was a contemporary of the Rama, and a Jew who lived in Germany sent him a question. He says, I can't concentrate on my learning if I wear a yarmulke. What am I supposed to do? So the Marshal gives a very big shtach to my family, the Yekis, and he says, be very careful of the Yekis. They'll sit and drink beer with a non-Jewish woman, but they'll yell at you if you don't wear a yarmulke. That's what he says about the Yekis. He says they're sticklers for menhagim, but they'll be over on who knows what, but if you don't wear a yarmulke, they're going to drive you crazy. So the Marshal, after telling him that, he tells him, try to find a material that will you'll feel comfortable with. So that's one thing a person should think about. If their child has sensory issues, maybe they have to think out of the box and figure out what material the child will be comfortable with. Another tool that helps children a lot is if you don't call it a kippah, you call it a crown. If you tell a child, this is your keter. If you introduce it to the child as their crown, so everyone likes to wear a crown. It might make sense to check with a therapist and see. Some children like the Bukhari kippot. The main point, in my opinion, is that you can't give in on this. Meaning, you don't want to find your child at age 6 not wearing a yarmulke. There are areas where you have to help the child figure out how to make it work for them. And it might mean getting a professional involved. But what you don't want is a situation where a child grows up and he's accustomed to walking around without a yarmulke. Yes, at age 3, it's normal that the child, sometimes it's on and sometimes it's off. But we need a graph, we need a momentum in a certain direction where over time he's wearing his yarmulke more and he's accustomed to that norm. To let the situation just go on and say the child's uncomfortable with it, so we'll just let it be this way, that's not good. I mean, in society, there's a certain statement about wearing a yarmulke and not wearing a yarmulke. So we have to give it that approach of thinking how we're going to help the child find what works for them. So we said two tools. One, to call it a crown. Two, to figure out if a material or a shape of a yarmulke can help. Three, possibly check with a therapist or a professional if it's reached those proportions. But number four, in terms of perspective, the goal has to be, we have to get there. This isn't something we can really let slide and not worry about. We have to worry about it and find the solution. Tov.